my name is Dick Anderson. I am an alcoholic. Everybody up here must have been taller than me.
I got it.
And not my first time at the podium. So, first of all, one of the key people for any event is always the voice. And it's the tempo, all of that stuff. And if there is a picture of someone in the encyclopedia for unbridled enthusiasm, it would be Darren. Totally unbridled. But did a great job, but I've enjoyed all the meetings. We've been very relaxed. This is the first time we've been back to Georgia since we moved. I was in, moved here after being sober 4 years. I moved here in 81, and we moved back in 2019. So I was here for 38 years, and I'm 72, so more than half my life was spent here. Now, I was here for a couple years before that, working for a New York ad agency that had an office here, but I was drinking too much to go to meetings. So if I knew any of you, it was not on purpose. And I want to thank Lee for inviting us, and Lee and Jessica last night. They took me to a place where all alcoholics end up sooner or later, the Waffle House. And we... believe it or not, we went over to the Waffle House over here, and they weren't open. They were only doing takeout. Now, who gets takeout from the Waffle House? Most of the people I know that eat at the Waffle House don't have a place to go home to take it to. That's a first. I had never, ever seen that. But we went down to the other Waffle House, and we had a good time down there. So... I appreciate it, and I appreciate the hospitality, and I appreciate especially the invitation. I spoke here in 2004, and then we spoke here in 2013? Okay, so we've been here a couple times. The first time was in Bainbridge, and I think Lee was taping it then, and I think John was taping it last time, and like all of you, I miss John. I was one of John's sponsors, and John was just full of light, and as I mentioned this afternoon, I don't think going to paradise is something that's a punishment. I think that's a final going home, and I'm sure that he has lit the place up once he got there. So, and I want to thank Maurice for being the host and for taking care of everything. And we've been semi-crippled since we came down there because neither one of us have been working during the pandemic. So, and Maurice made sure that everything we needed was taken care of. And this whole room is filled with a lot of, even though I'm from Kentucky, got sober in Kentucky, you know, like I said, the last 38 years I've been here, so almost the vast majority of the people that I know in AA are all in Georgia. And the only thing I want you to thank you for is I was here for 38 years, and Georgia had, I moved here in 81 after the 1980 title. So I move away, and as soon as I move away, the Braves win the World Series, and Georgia wins the National Football Championship. So you can thank me. And while I am a Wildcat and went to UK, here, unless Kentucky and Georgia were playing, I always wore a UGA a cap. And I had a niece who was a Georgia girl. They had a group of high academic girls and stuff like that, and they were, I don't know what their thing was, but I got to go down on the field for a warm-up, and I was down along the watching all the players, especially the year that Kentucky played them, and we had a quarterback named Jared Lorenzen, who was 340 pounds. He was bigger than any of the Georgian linemen the Kentucky quarterback was. If anybody, he died from being overweight about 2 years ago, so it's not that funny, but this was quite a few years ago. Anyway, and I'm grateful. We were happy to watch the title game, and we had been here before. We had season tickets back when the Braves were going every year, or semi-season tickets. You could buy them a half season. And Barbara, I was out of town on a trip, but Barbara got to see him the first World Series that they won. So anyway, we love y'all, and when we moved out of town, I was sick. I was in the hospital for several months after we moved to back to Kentucky, and I didn't know I was that sick, but I had a stomach infection, and so I was in the hospital for a while, and so I was worn out and didn't have any energy when we left, and so we didn't really have any, hey, we're moving, we just moved, and so it's I've got a project that it looks like I'm going to be coming back to Atlanta now and then to work on a TV project. So hopefully I'll be seeing some of you in meetings and maybe come to an assembly or so. But anyway, our heart's here. And thank you very much for inviting us once again, and especially to be part of the 25th. And you've had a great, great lineup of speakers. If you missed any of the speakers this weekend, you need to listen to the tapes and or whatever they are. Download, upload. Get a load on whatever it is, and but I thank that, I thank the committee, and you know, this is a pocket of enthusiasm. It was always in Georgia, was one of the places you could always count on people, and we produced an event that's we did a workshop this afternoon, and we did about wisdom, and we produced an event that's meant to bring out wisdom. We bring the senior members of AA to come in. And it's called Woodstock, Woodstock of the South, and we have 12 speakers, and there'll be, and we'll have the people that have the most time, most experience, and so forth, and it's, the last 2 years it's been off, but we're going to have it again, November 17th through the 20th, the same place, Legacy Lodge, so for those of you who come to that, you know, plan on it, we'll have the website up in the next week or so. And, you know, we lost Sandy, we lost, Tom I has, you know, dementia and can't come, lost Clancy, we lost several of our senior members, but Bob B will be there and a number of the people that you know. And a few new faces, but new old faces. So, anyway, and we appreciate it, and the speakers you've had this weekend have been tremendous. You know, if you haven't been here, James, his mom and I both are coming up on 45 years. His mom has 7 weeks more than I do. And she's been an anchor for me. I love her. James has been, and James got 36? Yeah. So did I mess that up already? 38, so 35. So anyway, but we're not sensitive about that kind of thing. And, yeah. Anyway, so, you know, James started off, kicked it off, and then Lee, who wasn't supposed to speak, gave a, if you didn't listen, just a tremendous talk and got us going on Friday morning. Don this morning. Don is somebody that I had never been in the same room with, although I had recommended Don several times. I called him one time because I was supposed to speak in Alaska and couldn't, and he was living as, you know, close to Alaska. But Polly loves him, so I had heard his tape, so I'd recommended him several times. And then also, I think we saw each other on Zoom. So I saw him, and he, you know, gave a great talk this morning. You know, especially for newcomers. I mean, he just hit it. And so I came up to give him a hug. I looked up, and I said, you're a lot taller than you are on Zoom. I mean, you watch somebody on Zoom, you have no idea how big they are. So Don is bigger than he looks. And so, and then tomorrow, the second person in the world that I have met named Belinda. And the first is part of my story, and I'll mention it later, but the second one is speaking tomorrow. I haven't heard her. Everybody else seems to have and loves her. And most of all, she loves a good friend of mine, Irvin Ducey, who is just a close, close friend of ours. And so I'm really looking forward to hearing her tomorrow morning. So, but I must say that the best speaker of the weekend was the Al-Anon speaker. No, I must say, and I don't know where. I think she was working in 2004, and that was in Bainbridge, I remember, and enjoyed that. And I misremembered that altogether. I said, oh, yeah, Lee spoke and Mari spoke. And I looked, and it was Jerry Jones and June Guinan. So it wasn't, I wasn't even close. But I was here. And so I had come to them before that, because if you're in service, you know, this is one of the events you don't want to miss. I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, at Bowman Field, which was an Army Air Corps base. My dad was a P-51 pilot. He came out of Hopkinsville, which was Western Kentucky, but he came from a military family, and we've got generations of people in the military. And he was deputy commander of a P-51 pilot at Bowman Field. My mother's father was a coal miner in Harlan County, but their family originally was from Hartwell, and they were very wealthy in 1860. In 1870, they were itinerant farm workers. They lost everything during the Civil War. And that my mother never even knew they had any money. But, you know, that's one of the things you find out in the genealogy thing. But here, but apparently a bunch of the people that ended up there, United States Steel had offered a home to live in and school and taking care of everything you need if you'd come up to them and work for United States Steel in either Lynch or Benham, Kentucky, which was in Harlan County. And so my grandfather at the age of 14 went into those mines. My mother came out of that town, and all of the kids of these coal miners escaped Harlan County as quickly as they could. And she was a stewardess for American Airlines at the same place where my dad was flying P-51s. They met there. They had their first date at a place called Air Devil's Inn, which had a big beer garden and orchestra. And then they had a honeymoon in the sky. There was a picture of him in the Courier Journal, because American Airlines he was a big hero in World War II. They paid for them to go down to Acapulco. And I was the gift that arrived 9 months later. And first kid. And we moved for a short time over to Langley, which is an Air Force base over in Virginia in the Tidewater area. And I kind of learned how to talk and walk over there. And then we moved back to Linden, Kentucky, a little town that was a little bit east of Louisville. And that's where I grew up. And being a service brat, it's a different kind of life, but we didn't move around a lot because when my dad moved back at that point, he was a little bit older when he got married. When he moved back, we stayed there. We only had one move. And so I went to grade school and high school, and I went to University of Kentucky. And so that was my home, and I enjoyed it. I didn't have any growing up. My dad is a fine man who was humble, and was well known for what he did for his flight and all this. After he retired as a pilot, he worked for the FAA and was an air traffic controller, and then he became a regional director of that. And he was just well thought of, but he was not somebody who boasted about anything, and he was the kind of guy that, you know, could have too many drinks on New Year's Eve and go back the next New Year's Eve and have too many drinks. I mean, he just, no drinking problem. As far as we know, I'm the first alcoholic of record in my family. So that was not a part of my growing up. And for some reason, though, and we went to church, and it wasn't one of those things where anybody was dogmatic. We just went to church on Sunday, and we would say prayer before we had our evening meal when my dad was home. And but for some reason, I felt a little bit uncomfortable at church because I saw these families that had, you know, they were smiling and they acted like they knew what God wanted to do, and they acted, and then some of them had more money than we did, and there was, you know, that whole thing, that lack of power is our dilemma. I didn't have the power to do what they did. I couldn't figure out how they were so happy and so forth. I did everything I was supposed to do, and I wasn't an unhappy kid, but I just didn't I didn't feel like I could really tell anybody what I really felt like. I was supposed to feel joy, and I didn't know what joy was. I didn't know what joy was until I'd been into AA for some time. But back then, I was supposed to have joy. It's a life full of joy, and I didn't know what it was. But there was one place where I could go, and I was involved in all these kind of activities that taught me great values. I was involved in Little League. I have no clue what all that blue stuff is. But somebody leave a pen up here. But this is the first. I've never had this happen, actually, where your fingers turn blue while you're speaking. So
put your hands in your pocket.
Yeah. Now where the heck was I? Yeah. Huh? Little League, yeah, okay. Little League, YMCA, 4-H, and Boy Scouts. And all of them said the same thing. You know, the Boy Scout handbook said that the way we please God best is to do something to help another person each day anonymously. And that's exactly what we do in here. But that was the way, what I was taught to do. And Little League, all of them had these values that were good values. And so I should have felt, you know, I've got good guidance there. You know, I had good guidance at home. But for whatever reason, I felt like I wasn't capable of being good. And I wasn't because I was a bad kid. I just felt a little bit disconnected. But there was one place now that we had when I was starting grade school. We got a little thing that had pictures on it moving. It was called TV. Black and white, you know, fuzzy picture, but they had great shows on there, and the shows themselves were great moral teachers. It was Andy Griffith's show, and Father Knows Best, and Leave It to Beaver, and all these shows. And in that one area there, I felt connected. I'd watch that, I'd see the characters, and if Opie or Wally ever got off the beam, I'd see the dad, they'd go talk to dad, and all dads had a pipe, and they'd take the pipe and turn it to one side. He'd say something wise, and then Opie or Wally would get back on the beam, and everything would be okay. And that became the one place where I would go and take any problem I had to that show. And whatever Opie and Wally learned, I learned. And so that I felt comfortable with. I couldn't tell my Little League coach or my scout leader what was going on with me, but I could certainly connect there. And strangely enough, I think God connects with us where he wants us to reach him, and that's what I have done for a living all my life, or most of my life, is write, produce, and it's around TV or film or entertainment or whatever, and that's where I felt connected, but I didn't feel connected in the other places. And now we go for the first time to something. TV was black and white, and it was small, but now we go to the drive-in with my parents, and while my little sister, who military, she retired as a full colonel. I got a younger brother that was in the Air Force, all military. We go, and there's this film up there that's 120 feet wide, and the screen is in Technicolor, and it's everything that I was looking for. It's this sense of power. There's a man up there, and all he does is he takes this pole that he's holding in his hand and puts it to one side, and the Red Sea parts. And the name of the film was The Ten Commandments. And I made two decisions that night. One, that I wanted to be around whatever that process was. Film. I didn't even call it film. Just that. Making a movie. Secondly, I wanted to be on God's side, because I had seen what Charlton Heston had done to Yul Brynner. And so the next day, much to the surprise of my parents, who had no idea I was having a spiritual awakening in the back of the 55 Ford, I went down the aisle at Linden Baptist Church and got dipped and dunked. They were playing We Surrender All, and all 3 feet of me was going down the aisle. And my parents, mouth open, watching me go down, and I surrendered all. But I was like a newcomer who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous or comes to one of these events, and then you come to it, but you don't take any steps to change. If we don't change here, it doesn't get better. We don't get better. Because it's not it getting better, it's we get better, it gets better. So I didn't take any steps. I didn't open up. I couldn't talk to anybody about anything that I needed to talk about. I just was there. I thought I'd go down the aisle and boom. And so after a while, I got resentful at these families that, you know, still seemed to be happy, or they seemed to have what they needed and all this. And I got angry, and I got angry at God. Because I remember there was a phrase called the chosen ones. Well, if these people who are happy are the chosen ones, and I just surrendered all I got, and I'm not getting the benefits of this, then I'm apparently not one of the chosen ones. And if anybody's played baseball and you go out there and they start picking signs and you're the one that's left and they don't pick you, you know what it feels like not to be the chosen ones. And I was angry at God, and I carried that resentment and anger towards God. And I'm in a world where we have this book called the Big Book, and we have other books that you read, in a world where we find out that the power comes from this outside, from this God, from this outside presence. It's not us. And I'm at odds with that power. I'm angry at that power. That power didn't pick me, so I'm now angry. So I'm defiant, which is the one characteristic you need to get into Alcoholics Anonymous. You need to be defiant to get in the door here. And that's who I was. I was defiant. But I still wasn't at the point where I would show much of that, because I was afraid to do that. I had my next spiritual experience when I was 14 years old. A buddy and I were playing Babe Ruth League baseball game the next day. We're both outfielders. His older brother brought us a half pint of gin and a six-pack of beer. And it was Ertl's 92, a beer they don't even make anymore. And I drank five of the beers, and he drank the gin. And from the very beginning, I was not a stay-at-home drunk. I was go-to-town drunk, and going to town when you're 14 means hitchhiking. And we hitchhiked up to a place called the White Castle, which they don't have down here. They're kind of like a downscale Crystal. And it's a place where you go at 2 or 3 in the morning when you're drunk to eat 14 of them with all these onions on them. It seemed like a good idea at 3 in the morning, but not so much the next day when you're waking up. And so we go to the White Castle, and after these five, and why I had five beers instead of six beers, I thought, you know, when anybody asked me, well, did you have two? I said, I only five. I didn't need the sixth one. And I didn't get sick. I went up there. I had a great time. There was a beautiful redhead behind the counter. They had a stainless steel counter. And we got something going on. She's 30. I'm 14. I have been shy about adults, but they're all around at midnight. There are a bunch of them at the White Castle. And back in those days, like I said, all the adults had ties, coach ties, you know, pipes, caps, and all this stuff. So I'm bouncing around. I'm talking to people there. I said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm in the insurance business over there. What are you doing? I'm in homeroom over at Westport. So, you know, I'm having a, and but my buddy Dave is not having the same spiritual experience I am. Dave is starting to get a little woozy. And I had never had a cup of coffee either, but I had seen in Perry Mason where if you have too much to drink, you have a cup of coffee, and it sobers you up so you can talk to the police. So I order a cup of coffee for Dave. Dave has the coffee, and it didn't have the desired effect. Dave, right in front of my redheaded girlfriend, throws up down the stainless steel counter. And it turns out, if it's after midnight and you're looking for a Louisville City policeman, the best place to find one is at the White Castle. And so two of them came over and said, what's wrong with your friend? I said, he's just had a little bit too much to drink. Really? How old is he? 14. How old are you? 14. So I was in Louisville City Jail 4 hours after my first drink. And that was pretty much the end of my social drinking. I drank as much as I could, whenever I could, wherever I could, from that point on. I was arrested 22 times by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. All of them were for, and none of them were for, strangely enough, only one of them was for DUI. But all of them, and only one was an actual crime where, it was anything more than drunkenness. But they were all for being clever with law enforcement, with authority figures, at some point. I remember one afternoon, and I'd start drinking in the afternoon. By the time I was 17, you have to be 21 to drink in Kentucky. By the time I'm 17, I've been going to this particular tavern in St. Matthews, which was East Louisville, for so long that you know, they were out of bartenders. Said, "Can you tend bar?" So I'm tending bar at 17 at this, and I'm not, at that point, 4 years young, too young to drink. But I can remember going to, you know, I had a couple drinks. I'm going to work at the bar that afternoon after high school, and my buddy is pulled on the side of the road. A policeman's talking to him. I get out and said, "Officer, what seems to be the problem here? Because I'm going to help out my buddy." And I did. My buddy got released, and they took me in. So, and that was it for the most part, up until my senior year. Now, here's what happened the first three times I take a drink. And if you're new, I didn't recognize the power that alcohol had over me until I had been in AA for some time. But the first time I took a drink, I got into trouble. The police, however, told my parents that I was very polite. My other friend was a little bit rowdy, but I was very polite and that I was okay, and they wouldn't have charged me if it hadn't been for my friend. And so that made me feel okay, and my dad felt okay until the next time I got arrested. But I got in trouble. The second thing that happened was we had transferred to a new school. I was starting quarterback at that school and announced as a starting quarterback before the season, before the school opened, because we started practicing ahead of time. And I was absolutely, totally in love with Belinda. And she was the captain of the cheerleaders. Now, I was JV quarterback, and she was captain of the JV cheerleaders. And I would have fought an SEC lineman for this girl. And she called after finding out about the arrest, and she said, "I need to tell you something. My father has a problem with alcohol. When he drinks, he gets mean, and it's not pretty, and I need to ask you not to have anything to drink while we're going out." And it took me less than 2 weeks to break up with her and give up the most important person in my life at that point, more important really than anybody I knew or had known. That was the most important relationship I had ever had, and it took me less than 2 weeks to give that up for alcohol. And when I came into AA, I would have thought, I said, I don't think alcohol affected me early on. But that all happened in the first couple of weeks of my drinking. I got arrested at my senior prom, and by this time, because of my behavior, I'd had the conversation where Dad says, "If you can't behave, we're going to have to, if you can't behave, you're going to have to live someplace else." You know, and what they say by that, they mean you need to behave. They don't mean move someplace else. But because I was already tending bar at 17, I knew a bunch of the guys up there that were going to U of L, and so I ended up sharing an apartment with a bunch of people while I'm in high school. So my parents had no idea where I was. But they found out the morning after my senior prom, because that night, I had been arrested and for two counts of assault and battery on a police officer. Now, I'm over 18 now, so this is a felony, and I'm legally not a minor anymore. But they still didn't know where I was until the next day, and the next day everybody found out, because on NBC, ABC, and CBS, it had me and my seven cellmates. There were eight of us in the cell. And the other seven were seven Black Panthers who'd been brought in, who'd been arrested for bringing a bunch of explosives into Louisville so they could blow up Churchill Downs. And so here come the seven Black Panthers and me on all three networks, and I'm in my little powder blue tuxedo jacket. And I'm just so grateful at that point that I'm not that scared little Baptist Boy Scout I was when I was a kid. I found myself. And I was already a writer when I was in high school, and I was a writer when I was in college. And you know, Hemingway, you know, ran with the bulls, and all these writers. And all the writers that I was looking at were full-blooded alcoholics. You know, Tennessee Williams, you know, choked to death on a medicine bottle when he was drunk. And you know, Hemingway shot himself in the head. You know, so, but that's okay. That comes later. You know, when you're 17 or 18, that doesn't matter. So I feel like I've found myself. I go to college. I'm in ROTC, and everybody in the family, you know, I got all these officers. Like I said, my little sister's a retired colonel, and I'm in ROTC. But there were a bunch of them sitting around now drinking and decided that, you know, we wanted to be like our dads. Our dads were heroes during World War II. We didn't want to miss out on Vietnam, and something about the news that night said Vietnam might be winding down, which wasn't true at all, but it was on the news. And so several of us, we all decided we would enlist, and we would go into the Marine Corps. And the only person leaving on a bus the next day was me. Because I continued drinking. The rest of them sobered up, and I don't think so. And so I go off. But strangely enough, I did fine. I had two tours to Vietnam, and I did fine in combat. I had, you know, the cancer that I had was caused by Agent Orange, and I've got some other things, and I had some injuries and stuff, but I made it back, and I seemed to do okay under those circumstances. I come back, and my last full active duty assignment was at the Pentagon, and at the Pentagon, you have to be there at like 6 o'clock in the morning, look good in a uniform, and I didn't finish ROTC, so I was a staff sergeant. I was not an officer, and so I was, you know, supposed to look good, supposed to act good, and all this stuff, and this is one of my, I told you I was engaged 6 times before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and nobody ever married me, but I was engaged 6 times, and this, at this particular time, my fiance was working the 4 a.m. to 12 noon shift at a local massage parlor, and so I had to drop her off I had to get her to work at 4, and then I only had, gave me about an hour and a half to go back, get ready, look good in the uniform, and get to the Pentagon, and so, you know, combat's one thing, but this is, you know, this, they're being, you know, this is ridiculous. I can't do this. So I decided to transfer out, and I go back to Louisville. And I didn't get out. I transferred into the reserves, but I still was getting off active duty. And I came back, and I met this absolutely beautiful woman. Every one of the women that I was engaged to looked like somebody out of the movies. And this girl looked like Olivia Newton-John. And another friend of mine, a Marine, and his wife that lived there, and I went, and I was hanging out with them, drinking, and this beautiful girl comes down, and I met her, and we fell in love, and that night we found love upstairs in her apartment and so forth, and we were just absolutely could not get enough of each other, and we were going to get married, we were picking names for the kids, and the honeymoon was going to be in Key West, and we just needed to figure out what to do with her husband, but alcoholics do not give up. We don't give up. It's just you just don't. I mean, nobody says that we don't have perseverance. And so I hung in there and hung in there, and I helped get her out of that bad marriage. And he was an attorney working. Nixon was running for re-election, and he was an attorney working for Nixon. And so we had a, you know, and when they got separated and all, he would come, he was kind of a nutcase, and he would, without the booze, he was just a regular sociopath. And so, but he would come knocking on her door, trying to break the door down. And so she called me, and I'd be flying over there. And I was an expert marksman and on active duty, so I go over there with a shotgun, and then he was an attorney, so he'd come around with a warrant. But I kept at it and kept at it until I got her out of that thing, and then we were going to get married, and we came down to 2 weeks before the wedding. We were getting presents coming in and all this stuff, and I didn't come home for 3 nights in a row. And so the truth is, I wasn't out messing around. But sometimes I needed to take a nap, and I just needed to catch up on some sleep. And I don't know where I was for 3 days, but I don't think it wasn't anything interesting. I just wasn't there. So she said, you know, there's a problem here, and we need to deal with that. And when anybody said anything that was at all critical, what I took that to mean was, I'm out the door, I'm gone. What she meant was, why don't we deal with this? But I didn't deal with anything. And so I left. Went to New York, ended up writing and producing some terrific commercials up there, and I did one that they bring out at Super Bowl time with a football player and a kid and a jersey and a Coca-Cola and all that, and making more money than I'd ever thought I'm making, flying around on Learjets and all that stuff, and at this whatever happened during that last two or three years, everything just accelerated. And I went from being a crazy wild drunk to my last year, I couldn't speak sometimes in the morning. And I was slurring my words when I was talking to people. And they offered to get me some help. They moved me to the Atlanta office because of the Coca-Cola account. And they offered to get me some help. And I said, no, thank you. I don't need it. So within a short time, I was out on the street. And I was homeless. And I was not... Don't get me wrong. I was not one of these people that lived under a bridge. I lived under a patio in a construction project they were building, so that they were building these new apartments, and there was a patio, a balcony above it, and I lived on the patio down below. And there was a liquor store I could go to, and because I had been, you know, management with the world's biggest ad agency on the world's biggest account, the Coca-Cola account, the bank was covering my checks until one day they didn't cover them because they told them I had been fired. And so I went in and the guy said, we can't, you know, we can't cash any more checks and we don't. And the only thing that came to me was, oh, God, I hope he gives me that whiskey. And so I, he did give me that bottle of whiskey, and I went around the corner, and that, where I was going to, where I slept was a piece of concrete slab, you know, above the balcony. And they hadn't put the windows or anything in, anything, but it was, that was there. And it was June, so it was warm. And I went around the corner, and that bottle somehow, almost in slow motion, just came out of my hands and hit that concrete and burst, and that whiskey was all over the ground. And I knew I couldn't go back to get a drink. He just told me I couldn't go in there anymore. There wasn't a liquor store nearby. I didn't have any way. I didn't have any money. And I carried at that point, I still have in a box everything I owned at that point, which was a pair of brown yellow golf pants, which were a practical color at the time, some loafers with a hole in the bottom of them, and a blue polo shirt, not polo brand, but you know, that kind of shirt. And and I carried on my sidearm a .45 that I had. And I got so angry at God because he brought me to this point. I was this kid that had all this talent, and people told me I had this talent. And, I seemed to get along with people from time to time. And I pulled it out. I got ready to put I had one in the chamber, and I got ready to pull the trigger. I was angry at God, and I just started screaming at God, God blank you, God blank you, God blank you. And something broke. I said, God help me, God help me, God help me. And a scene from a movie I had seen maybe 100 times, Days of Modern Roses, which was written by one of our members, came out. And it's where Jack Klugman's character walks up to Jack Lemmon and says, I understand you need help. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. And that scene right there was more real to me than anything else that was going on. And I walked up to a phone booth on a street corner, and I called. And when I called, I didn't have a dime. I called the operator. And I was crying, and I said, I'm an alcoholic. I need help. And 2 weeks before, the new manager of the Atlanta Central office, a woman named Helen, had gone with other people to Bell South to educate the operators to know where to refer the call if they ever got a call from an alcoholic. And they, this woman, connected me with Helen. And Helen retired a couple years ago, but she had 9 years at the time, so she's now, I'll have 45 in a couple months, she's got 54. Comfortable, retired at home, everybody loves her. And she stayed sober all that time, helping people like me. And she sent a guy out named Ed, and Ed picked me up and took me to a place, and they drive me out. I had DTs for 6 days, and I came out of the DTs, and I lied about having insurance. I didn't have any insurance, but they let me stay any place. And anyway, and when I got out of the DTs, there was a guy coming back in, and I said, I thought he was in here before he was getting out. And I said, well, he had a slip. And I said, what is that? And they said, and they explained it. I said, I can't go through this again. So I was getting ready to leave, and I knew where that weapon was. I'd put it in a place where I could get back to it, and I was going to go ahead and pull the trigger. And he said, no, wait, you need to listen to a talk. And so they played this tape of this guy who had 12 years sobriety, and he was a Marine, and he had a funny talk, but a powerful talk. His name was Sandy Beach, and it was Drop the Rock. And he saved my life. And Sandy and I became friends and got to know each other over a period of time. I was one of the five people that spoke, gave his eulogy when he passed. And I had never stopped thanking him for saving my life. And so I stuck in there, and then 2 weeks later they took me to a live meeting. It was the intergroup anniversary in Atlanta, and the speaker was Chuck Chamberlain. And then somebody, you know, it says, once you surrender, God provides whatever you need. Somebody gave me a car to drive, not gave me, but let me drive their car. People are nice, but not that nice. You know, they lent me a car to drive to Louisville. I was homeless, so I didn't have any place to stay in Atlanta. I go back up there thinking I'm going to get back together with my sweetheart, because now the one I was going to marry before, you know, she'll be happy to see me. She wasn't happy to see me. She wasn't going to Al-Anon, and she, you know, I had messed up pretty bad. Stayed with her for a couple of nights, and then I ended up staying one of the AAs up there. The old timers had a place. I stayed in his basement, and I ended up I could eat at their house and stay there. And I'd stay up. We didn't have a treatment center, so I stayed up at night helping new drunks come in. And I was the guy that stayed with them. If we needed a doctor, we called them. But otherwise, you know, so I had a purpose there. I was pouring coffee at an AA clubhouse called the Token Club, and that was it. And I had enough brain damage. It was confusing to me when you would talk to me and I couldn't follow. You start a sentence and three sentences later I've lost you. But I started getting better. But that's what I did during my first year. And I went to nine speaker meetings a week. And I went to one beginner's meeting where we had the first four chapters, and then we didn't even get into the steps until, except for one, two, and three at the beginning. But everybody that was there took me with them. They let me be part of. I had a lot of family recovery, so I was going into homes where there were healthy families, and they looked good, and they let me be part of it. And I felt, you know, that I was not, didn't deserve to be there. But they took care of me. They took me to events like this, and I didn't have any money, and they let me stay with them, and they would help pay the registration, and somebody would get a meal. And they said, don't worry about it. You can pass it on. And when I tried to pay them back, when I got, you know, well, that's what they wanted. They said, pass it on. We don't want it back. But they took care of me. And from that point until now, I have never been without a group of people that would do anything and everything to make sure that I stayed sober. And all I had to do was say, I need some help. And if you're here and you need some help, all you need to do is tell any of us. And you will never be without a group of people that will do anything and everything to make sure you have the same chance that I've had. That's what this program's about. So now the first thing you need if you do become a member of AA is you need to have a home group, and then you need to have a job. Because if you don't have a job, you're a guest. So I was in charge of, at my home group, I was the ashtray guy. And we had, in Louisville at that time, if you came into AA and you didn't smoke, it was mandatory that you learn how to smoke in order to stay sober. By this time in the meeting, there'd be a big thing of smoke over everybody, and you could vaguely see anybody on the second and third rows. And so I was the ashtray guy. In my home group, we had 10 ashtrays, and they were made out of, they were like Christmas tree colors, blue, gold, brown, blue, gold, red, and they're like Christmas tree colors anyway, corrugated metal, and you had to take a Brillo pad, really clean them out. And I was a good ashtray guy until I found out about rotation. And then they came to me one day and they said, we've got a new guy, and he is going to be the ashtray guy. And I said, I don't think so. I said, no, he needs this job to stay sober. And he did. They had gotten him down in Portland where all iron workers work, and he didn't know who his dad was. His mom was a working woman, and he was mentally handicapped, stuff. But they had, when they 12-stepped him, he was naked, about 300 pounds, 5'5", and hanging, and he had a chicken that he was just swinging around like this. They had somebody it was a famous story there because he was one of the most colorful 12-step calls they did. And so, but he took that job. And they said, but wait a minute, you know, when you get rid of one job, you get another job. And I said, really? Oh, yeah. I said, yeah, we want you to be the chairperson. I said, I'm going to be the chairperson? No, the chairperson. And so, but you know, there are only 10 ashtrays and there were 40 seats. So this was a promotion. And so, I learned about service early. The rewards of service were just tremendous. And so, really, truthfully, they got me. You know, if you're hanging around with people that are active and they're doing things and their stuff, you're going to do the same thing they do. So pick people that are winners. They say pick the winners. You know, everybody's a winner as a human being. But the people, by what they mean is pick people who are out there that everybody knows because they're doing something and they're making a difference. And so that's who I hung out with, and that's the sponsor I got. And I got to travel. I got to, my life started taking off. Now, as I said, the way we got sober then, we didn't get sober by having an academic program. We got sober because every time we could, we went and made a 12-step call on a wet drunk because there wasn't a treatment center there. So we would call on new drunks. What I did and my partner in this process was to go and watch. I didn't say anything. And they didn't say shut up. I mean, I didn't want to say anything. I didn't have anything. I didn't know what I was doing. But I went with them and I watched it. And then I would see some of these guys start to get sober. And one would have a month or 2 months. You know, a lot of them didn't get sober. But the ones who did, you start seeing them get better. And then when you see them get better, you see them that you're making progress. And the thing just works. That's the way this program works. And so I was happy. I was great. And then I started working. They wanted me to work through the steps. And I did the first three, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, the first of those steps, I only had one resentment. And it was some woman. And I don't remember her name now, but obviously she and I had a bad relationship. And so, only one. When I finally got to root core and my brain was starting to work, I was very angry at God. I was very angry at me. I was very angry. You know, I mean, I was angry at everybody and very resentful. And so I started going through and I started making my amends. And about halfway through the amends, that process that they talk about, you know, where things start to clear up, it started to happen. And I made, I went to this Baptist church that I've been calling Bad Mouth all the time. Because remember, that was a church where God denied me, where I wasn't one of the chosen ones. And I was very angry. And I went in and said, I've been calling them hypocrites and other things the whole time. And could I stay there and just be part of? And two things happened there that I wasn't prepared for. One was that there were people there. You know, not everybody in AA is wonderful, and not everybody in church is wonderful, but there were people in this church that actually were very nice people who cared for me and loved me just the same as they do in AA. They didn't understand the disease like we do, but they were nice people. I mean, they welcomed me and let me be part of it. That was one. So a door opened. Now, I was already comfortable in AA, but now I'm comfortable, you know, someplace else. The second thing that happened was there was a girl there that I met. There was two things I wasn't looking for. She was a seminary student and a good girl. And she, a beautiful blonde that was sitting there, and she and I have now been married. This will be our 38th year of wedded. And she's as active in Al-Anon as I am in AA. So she's a past Al-Anon delegate in Georgia. She was an Al-Anon delegate, 10 years before I was, I think, or 15 years. Yeah. Whatever she did, she showed me some fingers, but I'm not sure what that meant. So, but anyway, so that happened. So now I go to the church that I'd been in high school where I was really angry and where I'd actually defaced the building and all this stuff. And it was Harvey Brown Presbyterian, our family's Scottish, and that's, you know, Presbyterian Church used to be the old Scottish church. And I go in there, and I'm trying to find somebody to apologize to, and I couldn't find anybody. And there was nobody there. And I went into the chapel, and nobody. And then suddenly I realized who I was there for. I had been angry at God for so long, and here's my experience. There were people that I was angry at who really weren't at fault, but I forgave them, and then I realized they weren't at fault. And in this case, I had to forgive God. And I got down on my knees and started to forgive God. And the most profound experience I've ever had, it was like a wind that just blew through my heart. And I just felt lifted up, and whatever weight I had on my back just disappeared. And for the first time in my life, I felt like I fit in with man and with God. I had never had an experience where I felt close to God until that moment. And I walk out of there, and my life has never been the same. It's not that I haven't, you know, I've gone through all kinds of ups and downs and all that, but I have never doubted that there was a God that loved me, that helped me through all of that stuff before, being the stupid fool that I was, being as angry as I was, being somebody that didn't want to have anything to do with this God. And yet that power was taking care of me. And, you know, my brain was working a little bit, and so I went from being the guy that poured coffee at the Token Club to the guy came along and said, I'm doing the campaign for a guy that's running for mayor, and they need somebody to do the press and the advertising and et cetera. And I had worked for the Courier Journal there while I was still in college and worked for this big agency. So I handled that for him. He was elected, and then within a short time, I was the press secretary for the mayor and the director of public affairs for the city. So I go from being the guy that pours coffee at the club to being the press secretary for the mayor in about 2.5 years of sobriety. And especially to the people up there, I point out this. The last derby I went to when I was drinking, I woke up out in the infield, some guy was taking a pee on me. The first derby I went to sober, I had a police car take me and my date, and at this point I'd gotten kind of temporarily back with Olivia Newton-John, except that still didn't work out because she didn't go to Al-Anon. But anyway, but we had a police car that took us to the front gate, past all the VIPs. I had a seat in the mayor's box and a thing where I could go up and down Millionaire's Row. So it's the difference between drunk before and sober. Not for everybody, but for me it was. And so, but I got that experience. I've never had that experience. But that is not why I had that job. I had been arrested 22 times. When you get arrested, you don't get arrested by one person, you get arrested by three people. So there were 66 people, all of them unnamed except for the people of the assault and battery of a police officer. When you get a felony, they have the names. The rest of them, I had no idea who they were. So I'm going to make amends to these people. And seeing all these policemen we had gone and tried to help and knowing that they were going to lose their career if anybody found out they had a drinking problem, I went to the mayor and I said, look, can we set up an amnesty program where if they accept help, they don't lose their job? He said, sure. So my sponsor, a guy named Jack Sullivan, had done that for the railroad, so he came in and helped set up the program. All I did was ask if it could be done and then facilitate it. But the first six people that we 12-stepped were in the chief's office, and they come to the chief's office, and he tell them, okay, you're getting ready to lose your pension and get fired, or you can go with Dick. And so that's a great way to do a 12-step call, by the way. And so, and the third one was a guy who had, the night before, drunk in his own black and white, run into two Jefferson County policemen, knocked their car up, got out, got in a fist fight with him, and they locked him up. He didn't remember any of it, so he's in there that day. He does not want to go with me. Very angry, very defiant. He ended up later on getting his degree and running the EAP program for all of the public safety until he died about 4 or 5 years ago. And, you know, we don't have to know anything. You don't have to be an expert or anything. All you have to do is just show up and do what you're supposed to do. And that enabled me to be useful to these guys and to help them, and that was it. You know, now, I'm going through this. I've had this spiritual awakening, and there was a group that I went to Gethsemane every February, and it would be snowing outside, and it's a contemplative monastery, and a lot of the people in Louisville are Catholic. I'm not, but a lot of them are. And we would go, and just very healing and very quiet and very peaceful. And now I've had this spiritual awakening, and I know that God exists, and things are happening. And so I go to this, and this priest comes out and says, you boys, you're always talking about doing God's will. Do you know what God's will is? And none of us ventured a guess. There are about 12 of us. And he said, God's will is simple. It's to do the best you can right now, where you are, with what you've been given, to be useful to somebody else. If you do that, your Heavenly Father is going to be pleased with you, and He's going to give you whatever you need to have a bigger and better life. And He said, we are His children, And if you men had two boys, and they were both 7 years old, and you gave both of them a little red wagon, and one of them took that red wagon around the neighborhood and spread joy, and the other one took that red wagon and kicked it aside and said, I want a scooter, who would you give more to? And I had always been the one who took whatever I had and kicked it over here because I had to write down on my cocktail napkin what I wanted so I could get that job or that car or that date or whoever it was. That's who I was. I had never even thought that what I was already given was a gift that I was supposed to use for somebody else, and that if I did, I would be rewarded. I did not think that way. That's not the way I was built. But everything about my life changed at that point. And I started to do that, and things started to happen. And my life changed, and my life changed forever. And I still don't know anything better about how to live life than what that guy taught me that day. So, if you have come here and you have problems, and we've had plenty of problems in life, because that's part of life, if you have come here and you're not sure what you're supposed to do, if you've come here and you're not sure, you know, if you could even quit drinking, the power that is in this program is so magnificent. And it comes not with punishment, but with love. And to the extent that I surrendered and was willing to accept the love and just be useful, that's all. The highest rank you can have in AA is useful. And so if that can happen for you, you have the power to deal with anything. Barbara talked about it in her talk we had a year where we put our dog to sleep. We didn't have any children. We had put our dog to sleep. And then we lost her mom and dad within a week of each other, and then my mom, and was one of those, and, you know, we had some other things going on. And then I went in and was told I had esophageal cancer. Esophageal cancer is 95% fatal. And of those who do survive it, you don't generally get more than a couple of years. And I was delegate. At that time, and strangely, just for those who don't know, I didn't mean to be delegate. I had been DCM like 15 years earlier, and somebody, Joycey, called me to ask me if I would fill in for a DCM in this area, the district that nobody was working, and so I said I'd go over there for 2 months, and that would be it. And I went there, and then they elected me Metro DCM, and then I got elected alternate delegate. And that all happened in a very short time, and I wasn't looking for that at all. I really didn't think anybody would even know who I was, but, you know, God is really connected. And so, you know, just everything starts working out in ways that I wouldn't know. So I'm in the middle of this, but I don't know what to do. I mean, I was kind of stunned when you are told that you have, you know, terminal cancer. And, I can't tell her because, you know, she's just lost both her parents and our dog, which is like our child. And, I can't tell her. And that means I can't tell you because you don't gossip. And so nobody knew. In fact, when I told the alternate delegate, I said, you know, you're going to need to cover for me. I've got to have some tissue removed. Now, that's not a lie. I had to have some tissue removed. And but I didn't say I had cancer. And I said, I've got to have an operation or I'm going to have to go out of town to do it. And I found the one place I thought that could do it, they told me this guy had developed this new technique. It wasn't like the old stuff where you could just live for 2 years. It was a real, complete, total rebuild of your upper digestive system. He was out at the University of Southern California. I talked to him out there, and he couldn't do it. He couldn't take my insurance. That weekend, I was speaking at Key West at the Sunset Roundup on Saturday night, and a friend of mine was there speaking on Friday night, and Beth was speaking on Sunday morning, I think. Anyway, this friend, I couldn't pray. I was so angry because I was going to die because God couldn't get the right kind of insurance for me. I'm angry. I can't go to this place where they can save my life. And I said, I told him I couldn't pray. And he said, I say any prayer that I learned in the past and it'll click. And so I started saying the 23rd Psalm because I'd memorized it in the PTA in the third grade. And I'd used it in Vietnam. Pretty good prayer. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. And so, all of a sudden, I remembered before I got up to speak, my first sponsor, when I had called him one day and he said he had 6 malignant brain tumors, and I said, well, what are they going to do about it? He said, nothing. And I said, well, you don't sound scared. And he said, if God has been this good to me here, just imagine what he's got waiting for me on the other side. And I got up and I spoke and I said, I don't know where I'm going to be. But wherever I be, I'm going to be. I know that the loving, kind of loving God that I met, and you people, whether you're here or there, I'm going to be connected with. And on Monday, I got a phone call, and they said, the chief of surgery for here has left. He's gone to Rochester, New York. We sent him your information and the labs and the film and all that stuff, and you'll be getting a phone call from him. So I got a phone call from him, chief of surgery for this hospital in Rochester, New York. I didn't think I'd hear from him. Got a phone call from him, and he said, can you be up here? Can you leave Tuesday to come up here? And because I'd already been told that I need to do this in a hurry if I wanted to live. So now I tell Barbara that we're going to Rochester because I am having a little operation and I actually do have cancer, so she was a mess. But on the way up there, I wasn't sure what was going to happen, and I didn't know anybody in Rochester. And we got there, and there were 24 people in the parking lot at the hotel right next to the hospital, and they were waiting for us, and we had a new Al-Anon group. They took us to a meeting that night, a new AA group, new Al-Anon group, and Barbara was connected. And the next day we went to that hospital, and we go into the, we knew if it was going to work, God was going to have to meet, and we knew, went into the chapel, and the chapel had great big letters, a foot and a half deep in gold, that says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And we walked out to the lobby to see where God had brought us, and it was Strong Memorial Hospital, endowed by the family of Dr. Leonard Strong, who was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law, who helped start the Alcoholic Foundation. What I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, besides happiness and pleasure and enthusiasm and all the things we share, is something underneath called joy. And joy means that no matter what's going on, even if it looks like the ship's going down, I am going to be okay because I have a Father that will take me through anything. And if I'm going to the next dimension, that's where I'm going. But I'm going to be okay. And it wasn't my time. That was 2005. So that was 17 years ago. And I haven't had cancer for, since that operation. It's gone. If you're here and there's anything going on in your life that you're struggling with, the first thing you need to do is just tell somebody. And then, if you were lucky like me, I had a prayer partner named Keith Lewis. Listen to his tape if you can get one from Lee. But we prayed about things, and he prayed with me before I went up there. And he was just a wonderful guy. And he went. 2 years after I was supposed to go, he went. I was holding his hand when he did. And there is nothing that you cannot have. There is nothing, nothing. Your life can amount to everything it was supposed to be. You can find out who you were meant to be. You can find out who you were meant to be with. You can find out who you were supposed to help. And you can do it all here within the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now your life will overflow into the rest of the universe out there. And if you're like me, it should. Because you've got plenty, there are plenty of people that need our help out there that aren't alcoholics, that need just what we have that we get in Alcoholics Anonymous. But my prayer for you is that you find the same joy and that you surrender and you enjoy every bit of it. And I thank you for letting us be here.